So this is about what's been going on to modernize career work here at the college. And it's all about the Loeb Center for Career Exploration and Planning. And that whole series of words is very important. So it's all about a two-step career exploration and deciding what you may be interested in, what you may not be interested in, and then planning to go in that direction. Was anybody at Biddy's talk this morning? Okay, you notice she stumbled on the name. She couldn't remember the planning part. So we're still in the process of working this out, but we've made enormous progress. So let's go to the second slide. We're also having a technology issue. So this is to set some context. Amherst College has changed a lot. The world of work has changed a lot. And so the college now has to adapt to the realities beyond our borders here. This gives a little context for this. So you see, as people pretty well know now, you know, 45 in this particular class, who are rising sophomores, I believe, 45% U.S. students of color. The 55% I always find is a misleading term, so let's not talk about that, but a lot of people on financial aid. In fact, as we know, everybody's on financial aid because the cost per student is much higher than the comprehensive fee. 20% Pell eligible, good number. We've been varying between 20 and 30%. And you see the 11% first generation students. So those stats, the way that the college has changed, and by the way, you know, 7 to 11% international students on top of this. So the way the college has changed, that has presented challenges for us in terms of equipping students to leave here to take the next step. We'll get to this a little bit later, but one thing that is different than our class of 1964, now about 85% of students go to work when they leave the college. Most of us, because of the war, went to graduate school or something else. And so that's another indication of change. The expression at the bottom is one that comes from John Abele, class of 59, founder of Boston Scientific Corporation, a Fortune 500 company. And he's done a lot of work here to fund internships for not-for-profits. So that's a little expression he uses in terms of setting the context for the way the world is changing. Let's just stick on this for a second. So I don't have a slide on this one, but some of the goals for the Loeb Center are derived from the name. So it's the perfect name, I think, named by Michael Loeb, class of 77, career exploration and planning, the two steps I mentioned before. So it's about those two functions. It's also about building social capital. So now a lot of our students come to college who bring with them very little social capital. And it's incumbent upon us to help them build that while they're here. The other thing we've realized, and I've realized this painfully in my own experiences in advising kids, is everything's starting earlier so that you can't any longer really, if you're looking for a job, you can't any longer really start to pay attention senior year. For instance, in investment banking, where I spent 35 years, now if you don't have an internship this summer with an investment bank, the summer before your senior year, you cannot get a job. So everything has to start earlier, and it also has to start earlier for the first generation low income students, who we now call Mickle-John Fellows. There'll be more on that as we go along. And we're encouraging students to start to interact with the Loeb Center as soon as they arrive on campus. So, the alums here, how many of you actively used the Career Center when you were here? One hand. I don't think any of us did. It was just, yeah, Ken, there was one.
There was.
It may have been in the basement of the alumni house.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's what we figured out, is that that's where it was for many, many, many decades.
And I should have, at the beginning, everybody knows, this is Emily Griffin, who runs the Career Center and is a godsend. And she'll be chiming in here in a bit. So the structures here are industry-specific advising, so industry by industry, more on that later, paid internships, treks. People, Biddy pointed this out this morning, a trek is it's basically a field trip on steroids, like we used to take in school or in elementary school. It's probably, yeah, beer is probably true. And the importance of branding. So as we go through here, you'll hear a lot about branding, various activities, rather than calling something generic, they're actually called something so people identify with them and remember them. The two big brands are Micklejohn Fellows, which we'll talk about, and Charles Hamilton Houston Internships. We'll talk about that too. And Biddy also said this morning, the last part of this, is that why are we doing this? Part of it is building social capital, making what we do here practical as well as academic, so they interact. And in doing so, Biddy mentioned this morning Archibald MacLeish. Did you hear her say that? And she talked about his prediction, or his conclusion, that the liberal arts were doomed because they are not usable. And so as we begin this work, one of the objectives was to fortify the liberal arts. So you bolt on very modern career operation alongside the curriculum, the academics here, and you have a stronger entity. So it fortifies the liberal arts rather than competes with it. Can we go to the next slide? Actually, let's skip one head. I'm going to bounce around here a little bit. So here's a timeline. And a lot of this started in, the way I think of it, started in 2011, a little over 8 years ago. It came, many of these thoughts came from the University of Chicago. And I was a trustee at UChicago for 10 years. And I'm still a life trustee, a grandfathered life trustee here. And UChicago has a very modern career operation. It also is one of the most rigorous places in the country. Still one of the two places that I know of that has a core curriculum, it and Columbia. So it's a very rigorous place, but they have a career operation that's started to modernize over 20 years ago. And as a result of that, I learned about their career-specific advising work. And then I talked them into repurposing one of their programs from careers in higher education to careers in education professions, so pre-K through higher ed. And then I started to steal their stuff, which is with their full cooperation. So then we started to work on modernizing career operations both here and at Grinnell College in Iowa, where my wife was a trustee. So that's 2011. In 2013, the first specialized program, career advising program, was education professions. And then we took the pre-med advising program and turned it into careers in health professions. So then we had two of them. Then in 2014, we took our first trek, and you organized that?
I didn't organize the very first one, but I co-facilitated the very first one, and we've run about four to Silicon Valley since then. We do about six or seven treks per year. And like Chuck said, I think it's a great description, a field trip on steroids. We go to a city that serves as a particular professional ecosystem. So Silicon Valley, we explore technology. We go to LA to explore entertainment. We go to New York to explore lots of different industries, obviously. Our most recent trek is the climate action trek that we ran in Boston over the last spring break. That was a new one for us. So it allows us some flexibility to be responsive to areas that students are interested in, and to be responsive to emerging opportunities in different industries. But the way that we are really able to build these trips, which usually consist of about 20 site visits at places of work of alumni, so we go into different companies, we have alumni receptions, we're able to do it successfully because of the industry specialization model, because each one has an advisor who has experience in that industry, who devotes all of their time to one-on-one advising with students interested in those paths, cultivating networks of alumni in those industries so they can really go in depth. They don't have to be everything to all people. They can really kind of narrow and focus. And that's really what undergirds the quality of the Trek program.
And the speaking of treks, that my wife Penny Sebring and I have gone on three treks with the different colleges. So we went to these are all with the Ed Pros Education Professions students. One to Finland, one to South with UChicago, one to South Africa with Grinnell, and one to post Katrina New Orleans. You know, major changes in the education landscape. With Amherst. So those are three examples of treks that I've actually gone on with students. And then in 2015, Doug Grissom, co-chair of the campaign, trustee, class of 89, there's zillions of class of 89 people around here. I keep kidding about that. They're everywhere. The seed funded the business and finance program in 2015. Next slide, please. Then 2016, so we got all this stuff going, and then Michael Loeb, class of 77, lives in New York, I would best describe as a serial entrepreneur. He came along and named the center. So that's when we started with a new name. And that's also part of the branding. And then Emily was at the center and was named director in 2016. Then the next year we started an advisory council, and Doug and Beth Swanson are on the advisory council as
well. Sonia Clark here in the last row, sorry. Oh, there,
she snuck in.
She snuck in.
Sonia Clark, another class of 89, who is now on the faculty here, and her husband Daryl, who spoke this morning. And it was a great talk this morning. So Sonia's on the council as well. Then 2018, we started an arts and communication program, and alumni seed funded that, and at this point they want to remain anonymous. We started the two things which we'll talk in some depth about. Micklejohn Fellows program that was started indirectly and through another initiative by Arthur Koenig, who's class of 66. And we'll talk more about that. And then the Charles Hamilton Houston internship program. And I was I was pushing that and helping to fund it, along with a couple of other anonymous donors. And then the news this year is that we have a verbal commitment, not yet signed, I think, to endow.
Any day now.
The check is in the mail. To endow the business and finance program. And then we have two alumni who are together going to help launch the science and technology program. So next slide. So this is the lineup we now have.
Go back.
Thanks. Sorry. Yeah, go back.
You warned her.
Yeah, there you go. Sorry. That's helpful. So this is about, this is the result of these industry-specific advising programs. And you'll see the lineup there. Where does government and nonprofit stand?
Government, nonprofit, and law are not yet funded, seed funded or otherwise. It's the advising area is covered by an existing staff member in the Loeb Center who has other responsibilities.
So we've got five of the six either seed funded or one about to be endowed with some discussions about endowing some of the others. Interesting here that 65% of students in 2017-18 attended at least one session. So we're getting people to come to the Loeb Center actually use it. And
I would just insert here, I just got a benchmarking report that we have every year from our peer schools in a consortium that we belong to. So peer schools would include places like Williams, Middlebury, Pomona, and our rate is much, much higher than the average for a lot of those other schools. I'm a pretty competitive person, so I always like to say this, but I think the average rate for one-on-one advising sessions for, you know, schools like us are in the low 40s. So the fact that we're above 65 is really significant. And that's really only happened in the past few years with the implementation of these new programs. So it's clearly effective.
Yeah, we're trying to stay ahead of the trend here because other than UChicago, most other places are not very sophisticated in this area, but they're starting to learn. So all the NESCAC schools are onto this.
Yeah.
So this will become competitive, which is a good thing because it's good for the students. We also learned from UChicago that as we were building out and paying attention to starting these six career programs, we were told, and I still remember it, don't you, that we should also had to pay it more serious attention at that time, this is a year or two ago, to building out the internship side. That advising alone without the internships were ineffective. Mm-hmm. So we turned our attention to that too. Let's go to next, keep going, to the Houston, back yep. one. Yeah. So we have named the internship program for Charles Hamilton Houston, whose painting's right up there, portrait's right up there. And are you going to do this, Mike?
Sure. So Charles Hamilton Houston was Amherst class of 1915, and he went on to attend Harvard Law School, and then he was the first African-American editor of the Law Review there, and then he was a vice dean at Howard University's Law School. The thing that really makes him most famous is that he was a mentor to Thurgood Marshall. So kind of informally around the Loeb Center, we refer to Houston as the man who broke Jim Crow because he was responsible for designing the legal strategy that eventually led, unfortunately after his death, to Brown versus the Board of Education. So really, really significant, obviously, for our country and for Amherst. And so the opportunity to launch a program that all students would be really proud to be affiliated with, and hopefully many, many employers and alumni would be very proud to be affiliated with. It's a nice opportunity to honor Houston.
And these will over time be called Houstons. So at UChicago, we have a major internship program that that is was the first thing they did over 20 years ago. It's called the Jeff Metcalf Internship Program, Metcalf. And he was a faculty member. And this summer, they will have 2,700 paid internships. So that shows you what's possible in this area. Do you want to talk about the next slide?
Oh, sure, and not more about the about program.
No, let's talk about the Hamilton program.
We
can't quite see
the focus. Oh, great, that's right, Sarah. Thank you so much. The focus of the Houston platform is to bring a lot of quality control to student internships. First of all, to build a portfolio of internships that are paid is really important, especially as Chuck noted earlier. You know, with our student body, you know, there are many students, you know, really across a lot of socioeconomic levels that would really struggle with an unpaid internship over the summer. The financial obstacle of having to figure out a summer in a city, having unpaid work. And so we're really focusing on building relationships with employers who pay interns and creating pipelines year after year after year for Amherst students. We also have sources of funding at the college to allow us to bring nonprofit organizations into that portfolio who maybe don't pay their interns, but we will step in and provide that stipend for Amherst students. So it creates a lot of clarity and hopefully less anxiety for students to pursue those internships. The other piece of the puzzle is that we're going to work really closely with those supervisors, talk to them before the summer, do a midsummer check-in, require a performance review of the student at the end of the summer, so that the employers and supervisors at these internships are really focused on what are the student learning goals, how are these internships translating into transferable skills for the student that will really provide them traction for their eventual job search, as opposed to what we know a lot of internships can be, which is more clerical, maybe not a lot of attention on the experience for the student. So it really gives us a platform for focusing on the experience and the quality. And of course, that takes a lot more staff, which is why we need quite a few more resources to do this, and Chuck really deeply understands this through his experience with the Metcalf program, so it's really a joy to not have to explain that, that we need more staff. So that's the focus of the program, and our goals are pretty ambitious, to have 500 of these positions, 500 slots for students by 2023, but we kind of pace that against how UChicago has developed their numbers and, you know, relative to their student body.
And you notice that it has, like anything that, again, this is the importance of branding, anything that a brand has to stand for something, and it has to consistently stand for it. Otherwise, it's worthless. That's just like an individual's reputation. Unless you're consistent in what you do, then you will not have a good personal reputation. So part of it's the 8 weeks minimum and paid $4,500 minimum, rather than people trying to do it on the cheap. And as Emily said, or as we mentioned earlier, that the great proportion of these will be for profit, not for profit, but where they're not for profit, the college will pay through stipends. So anybody who has what it will be termed a Houston will meet those criteria. We also, did you mention Handshake?
No. So we have a new online platform that helps us manage all of the job postings, internship postings that are available to students, and which will increase with this program clearly, as well as helping students connect with the center overall for advising appointments, RSVPing for our events, and a lot of other resources. So this is the cutting edge program that's available to higher ed right now. And we just launched it this past year, and it's been great. We have an 85% digital engagement rate with it, so it was a good investment.
Yeah, it's one-stop shopping.
Yeah.
A platform for one-stop shopping for students, rather than having to wander around the campus figuring out who knows what on what internship or anything else like, or job, full-time job. Let's go back a couple of slides to Mickle John. There you go.
So good.
So the the other major initiative here is called the Alexander Micklejohn Fellowship Program, or Fellows Program. Micklejohn, do anybody know anything about Micklejohn? Bob, you do? You shaking your head? Yeah. I'm going to borrow that.
Yes.
That he broke some china. Yeah, so he was president from 1912 to 21. Interestingly, and his portrait's right back there, my right of the doorway. And I didn't know a lot about him myself. And he was 1912 to 21. The trustees got rid of him in 21. And but he was remarkable, and Biddy Martin in particular is a big fan of his. So we've started to learn about him more. and she and Catherine Epstein, the now provost and dean of the faculty, were in favor of naming this program for him. Just a little more about him. He was the youngest president of Amherst College. He was 41 years old when he started. When he came, there's a biography. There's a book being written for the bicentennial, and thanks to Doug, I just took a look at the manuscript, and they describe Micklejohn in a couple of ways. They said he quote observed that the college was an agreeable, leisurely, semi-educational country club when he arrived. So remember, it started, I'll get going on this, but it started in 1818 with the charity fund 3 years before we opened our doors. That was the beginning of the endowment. Most people don't remember that, or that's not highlighted. It should be highlighted. So the place started with a charity fund to begin with. That's where the famous line about indigent young men of piety, that comes from the charter of the charity fund, not the charter of the college. And so it was very, very oriented to producing ministers in the early days. Then the place was kind of captured by the elites, and that continued, you know, well into the 20th century. And so when Micklejohn came, it was described like that. And he forced it. He forced out underperforming faculty, and revised the curriculum dramatically, and laid the groundwork for what Amherst College is today. So he laid the. He made it a rigorous place, rather than a finishing school, if you will. And the other interesting part from this manuscript is he predicted that 100 years after he was president. He predicted three things. One of them I'll mention today was that the place should be open to diversity. He's talking about this in the early 20th century. So that's why we've named it for him. Next slide, please. So what are Micklejohns? This kind of comes after what UChicago's doing as well. They have a massive program called the Odyssey Scholars Program. They got a gift of $100 million. That had to be matched 1.5 times in a 10-year period to endow its program that's comparable to ours, what we have now started as the Micklejohn Fellows Program. It's for low-income and or first-generation students. It's a much more positive thing than calling students first-gen or low-income. I was a first-gen student, not a low-income student. Anybody else first-gen here? Ken, were you? And I remember distinctly being, kind of a little bit of diversity at that time when we had in the early 60s, and very little other types of diversity. And so what we've learned from Odyssey at UChicago is that if you actually call it something, are intentional about what it means, that students will identify with it in a very positive way. It stuck with me. I remember being on a trip with the college, the undergraduate college at UChicago, to London. And at the end, I'm on a college council there. It's like a non-fiduciary board of trustees. And a first-year student got up to talk to this group of adults and introduced herself as a Questbridge scholar and an Odyssey scholar. It was really cool. So she viewed it, you can tell I'm emotional about it. That's a very positive thing to do. So what it does is, so we're modeling ours after theirs. And among other things, as you see on the slide, you know, guaranteed Houston in the first or second summer. UChicago now guarantees every Odyssey scholar a Metcalf internship first summer. So the whole idea that you got to go, you got to start early, and that's particularly true of Odyssey scholars or Metcalfs here. Wraparound services, as it says, both career, academic, social, and financial. You see the numbers, 150 in the class that just, the first year class that just ended. That's about 30% of the class were Micklejohns.
Or a third. Yeah, third, that's right, yeah. Okay.
And then the incoming class, that was an aberration. We probably won't be able to afford to stay at that level with about 30% of the class. The incoming class will probably be about 25%, still very high for elite colleges. And you notice that Micklejohns, the first cohort of Micklejohns this past academic year, 98% met with a Loeb advisor. The other thing to point out is that none of the 150 were on academic warning. First time that we can remember that was the case with this cohort of students. Next one. And we're almost done, and we'll take questions. The outcomes. So it speaks for itself. We're very intent on having students with plans in place before they graduate. And the other interesting thing about this slide, you see the 86% number? So most of us would think that a ton of our students go directly to graduate school. Not true. For a whole host of reasons. You can understand business schools now, where I went directly to Wharton, partly Vietnam, partly they would take me without any experience. Now that's not the case. A lot of students go to law school. Is this right, Brian? A lot of students go to law school and they do something in between before they go to law.
It's become much more complicated.
Yeah.
So everything's happening that way. I don't know if med school is the same way. One or two gaps.
And I will say, you know, the rate of Amherst alumni going to graduate school is still quite high. It's about 85% within 5 years of graduating. So the overall rates of further education are not down dramatically. It's still down from your generation for sure, but not as dramatically if it's just that people take more time.
Next page, please. So this is where they go, and this will surprise you. So the top one is education, which is broad. So it means teaching, like TFA, you see at the bottom of the other side of the page. Teaching of all sorts, educational research. Actually, my wife, who co-founded a significant educational research operation at UChicago, called the Consortium on School Research, hired a woman through Emily, class of 18. So she's just finishing her first year. She's not quite finished her first year yet. And so there's education research. She's basically running the place already. She's really great.
Classic Amherst.
And policy, yeah, policy and all sorts of other stuff. So education's a big one. You know, we break out the what could be clumped into business with financial services, consulting, and business otherwise. So that would be, in total, a larger number than education. And then you see the other fields. And then you'll see some of the employers. And so we're, through the internship program, we think this will also benefit us in terms of our relationship with full-time employers. Next slide. So this is basically a picture of, you know, academics on the one side, the classroom, and careers on the other side, students on a trek, and the whole idea that, back to the idea of fortifying the liberal arts, so fortifying the classroom with real life experiences that will lead to full-time employment. That's the summary of what we're doing. We'd appreciate reactions and questions. Tony?
For first destinations after graduating,
that okay, doesn't capture. So, what's their final destinations then?
I don't have the data on what are final. It's always in progress.
But isn't that, even as a first destination, isn't that kind of low?
It's, you know, it's, yeah. I mean, I agree with you. I think that that's a bit low. I think that a lot of the opportunities. Are you speaking like specifically government, not just nonprofit? Is your question about like going into government?
I agree. I think people go into service and giving back in other fields.
Exactly.
You know, I know like Steve Downs, as an example in the movie, you know, went into law, but he was in he was working a judicial, you know, evaluating judges. He was not in private practice of law, and then has done a lot of pro bono stuff. But that's my question. It seems like the whole thing of getting into your career and your branding and your what you're doing, kind of, I don't know, it seems to me that it's sort of blanking out the idea of service or public, you know, I think government now has a bad name, but I it's kind of discouraging that people are not really thinking of that.
Well, I think there are a couple things. I think that people who go into research, so there's a lot of students who go into science research either on their way to a PhD before med school, or maybe sometimes that's their terminal path, although not usually. And then students who go into the field of education look at both of those fields as being part of a whole of public service. And we certainly look at it that way. When we're looking at internships to fund, we're thinking about all of those sectors as having a lot of public service opportunities. But I'll also say that it's the way the different sectors are set up in terms of on-ramp opportunities for students in their very first jobs. There are some sectors that have really well-trod paths for first jobs, and other sectors that you need to work your way into, you know, through other means laterally.
Yeah, I look at it very differently. So if you add 21% for education, and 6% for government nonprofit, it's a significant proportion of the class. So I view education as service. In my own case, I was 35 years at Merrill Lynch Investment Banking, and then for about, as Beth knows, for about 20 years, I've been working full-time in the education space. This being part of it, but only a small part, a lot of it is pre-K-12. I'd like to say that I went from working for pay to paying to work. So I do it from the platform of our family foundation. So I think you'll see a lot of people at the college doing that. Beth Swanson here, 95, six. Sorry. is a perfect example where she's worked for a family foundation, Penny Pritzker's family foundation, was essentially the deputy for education for Rahm Emanuel in Chicago. Worked at the Joyce Foundation, and there's one other one I'm missing, but now is the CEO of a not-for-profit called A Better Chicago. So perfect example of what we're doing. So the other thing I'd say about that is, I mentioned John Abele earlier, the Boston Scientific guy. Some years ago, maybe 10 years ago, we started a thing called the Center for Community Engagement.
That was his investment, yep.
And it was the baby step the college took to actually helping students think about what they're going to do after they leave. And it's what the college could do. You can tell it in my voice, that they could only think about helping kids get into not-for-profits. They thought it was verboten to do something in for-profit. But in fact, the world overwhelmingly is for-profit. And now we've basically merged the two activities. There's still a Center for Community Engagement, but the real gist of the work is done under the Loeb Center, both for-profit and not-for-profit. Sorry to go on so long. Yes, Steve.
For internships. One was business and finance, am I correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, at least when we were at college, if you were interested in business and finance, you had one choice. You could take economics, but you couldn't take anything really in business and finance.
Right.
Has the college changed the curriculum in such a way to line up at all with these tracks that we're doing?
No.
And won't.
And we won't.
So the thing we find, so if you look at the young alumni, it's actually startling. How many are, in the business world and in the tech world, particularly, and in both private equity and investment banking, the investment side of things. It's a huge number. So what we find is that this is the whole argument about the liberal arts, that you don't really need a pre-professional business kind of preparation to both get a job and to be successful in it. But it's always adapting. The place is always adapting some. So Biddy talked this morning about the fact we now have a statistics major. So if you can, two of the most popular majors now are statistics and math. And so there's enough preparation that our students are able to get jobs at top financial services places. And you see financial services is 18% of the graduating.
Tom Ergot has a question.
So how do transfer students fit into your program?
They would fit not in any particular way, except that many of them would be Micklejohn fellows, and they'd come in late.
What? Yeah, they're not technically deemed as Micklejohn fellows, transfer students, but they work with the same advisor who's focused on the Micklejohn fellows population. She serves transfer students. She works with a staff member in the Office of Diversity and Inclusion whose population includes transfer students, veterans, DACA, and undocumented students. And she works very closely with him to make sure that she's advising his students from a career perspective. So that's how we've brought it in. I know that admission would really love us to make transfer students Micklejohn. Most of our transfer students would be Micklejohns if they came in their first year, but we'll probably get there.
Tony?
You would be recommended to meet with one of our two generalist advisors. So we have the industry specialization people, and then we have two people who are devoted to early exploration, undecided, and they have a very special type of advising appointment. It's an hour long. It's longer than our typical advising appointments. They have kind of a whole toolkit that they can work, that they can use to work with those students. So a few different kinds of assessments, reflection activities, a lot of conversation on what are your skills? What do you care about? What's important, you know, within your family, your community of origin? What are your values? It's just starting there. And hopefully kind of building to a point where as the student moves through their academic work and more conversations with the, with an advisor, in that capacity, they might be attracted to one or more of the specialization areas and kind of dabble until they get a little bit more of a focus. So we have a very, very special process for people who come in not knowing. We love those people.
Yeah, I think the whole idea here is that some people, you know, some of my classmates here would have come of thinking that they're going to med school, right? Or vet school, or law school.
Yeah.
You know, I came here first gen, father, a very good insurance salesman, high school educated, mother is a nurse. I didn't have a clue. I mean, I didn't even know what this place was before I got a letter from the DARP, as people know. And so I wandered around. I wandered around in business school. I didn't even know what I was going to do after getting out of Wharton. When I landed in stint in the service, and then landed in investment banking, and I thought it was, there was no difference between Merrill Lynch and McKinsey. I had no clue until I showed up and realized this was a commercial enterprise, not an academic advisory enterprise. So, good example. And what we're trying to do here is give students structured ways to think about, hi Ray, think about what they might do. The other thing that always sticks in my mind, I was at a college council meeting at University of Chicago, and we were talking about what they call career advancement. That's not a good name of their operation. We have a much better name. And we're talking about what they do, and a member of the council sticks his hand up, and no offense to the lawyers in the room, but said, I've been a lawyer for 20 years. If I had only known, I wouldn't have gone to law school, because I didn't know what being a lawyer was like. Brian's shaking his head. I wouldn't know what it was like until I got there. So what we're doing here is trying to give them the opportunity to see what it might be like before they start going down the path. So we are probably close to end of time.
Close. Yeah. That is not.
We don't
do that.
We have some specialists down the hill. Actually, Emily does that on the side.
We'll talk.
So thank you, John.
What? Tony and I had breakfast this morning, and I recounted that from seventh grade on, I wanted to be a physician.
Right. Want to use the mic?
Yeah, but there was a moment, and we both are on admissions committees now, and it's remarkable the number of people who are not in lockstep. They take a year or two or three off, and it may not be career development, but you know, they're very highly regarded applicants because they have a unique experience outside of just lockstep.
So yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's exactly right. That, again, the world has changed. And, you know, our class didn't have much choice because of the Vietnam War, right? When we left here, if we did not go to an exempt activity or go to graduate school, we would have been drafted. So we didn't have any choice. But then later on, after the war ends, then the business schools start to say, we're going to force people to get experience before they are accepted. And then the investment banks swooped in and said, during that interim, we're going to fill it up. We're going to fill that void by creating analyst programs. So that's a perfect example of how the world has changed. And without these kind of specialized programs where the advisors know what's going on in the field, health professions. Unless we had people who were knowledgeable about what's happening and changing in health professions, then you're out of luck because you're not aware of the changes. So thank you very much for coming.
Thanks.
We appreciate it.